Yeah, they're mostly out. So we've been getting some rain here the last few days, and everything hopes to be back to normal. I think they're going to have a rough time up there like they did last time.
Okay.
All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com. Be sure to check us out on social media at DogWorksRadio. And joining us from California is the co-host of Mushing Radio. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Robert. Sort of hoping to ease into fall here in California, and I know that it's been getting a little bit colder up there in Alaska as well. So it looks like we should soon be heading into training season, heavy training season, and the first snowfall hopefully is not too far in the future.
That is right. Typically around the 1st of September is when training starts in earnest for a lot of the sled dog teams. And you will know it by seeing a lot of the dog teams running up and down the park's highway. There's a trail on both sides of the road there. And you'll often see the teams with ATVs going back and forth. And it really shows that that Willow, Alaska is the sled dog capital of the world. And just a quick update on our last show, we talked a lot about the fires up here in Willow and how they impacted a lot of the local community, not only up here, but also down on the Kenai Peninsula. There was a large fire down there and several mushers had to evacuate, but I don't think any of those kennels were ones affected or where they lost their homes. So thankfully for that, and I know it's going to be a long rebuilding process for a lot of the families up there. I think they lost about 50 homes or so and quite a few outbuildings and even a campground and a kind of a trading post restaurant type thing up here in Willow. So it was a big fire season up here, but I think now with the recent rains and hopefully the upcoming snow, we're going to be able to put that behind us and move forward. How are things down in your neck of the woods, Alex?
You know, we've been pretty lucky so far this summer. It hasn't been that bad in terms of the fires. You know, as we've discussed with the climate changing, it seems like the fire seasons pretty much everywhere are going to be a little bit more dramatic. And so that's something that we all really have to keep an eye on and, you know, be aware of where fires are and what the evacuation procedures are and, you know, when it's time to evacuate and when, you know, and to be prepared in case you have to do that. There's one right. Other small thing that I wanted to mention before we kick into our main topic. And we had talked a while ago when there were Iditarod signups that Jeff King had not signed up this year. And I saw recently, I hadn't heard anything about what was going on with him or what he was thinking, but I saw a comment in a different thread where someone was talking about this and Jeff said that he had recently had shoulder surgery and he is not certain that he's going to be recovered enough to run Iditarod next year. And so he's sort of taking that, you know, on a day by day, week by week basis and doing his rehabilitation and you know, reworking the shoulder and he said that he will come back and will race again. It's just not clear that he'll be able to run Iditarod next year.
I had not heard that, so good luck to Jeff out there and hope he heals well with that. And, yeah, those off-season surgeries, they can get you. It's very similar to off-season in other sports where they do their rehab and their ACL surgeries and all of that. Mushers can get banged up, too, especially as we get up there in age. And Jeff is one that says all the time he's not a spring chicken anymore, doesn't he?
Yeah, he really does. And, you know, as someone who has my own shoulder issues, and has been healing from a shoulder injury, know that that can be a very, very tricky thing. So I'm hopeful and I'm confident that he has all of the best people working with him. And, you know, as you said, these things take a little bit longer to heal as we tend to get a little bit older. And so hopefully he is doing well and will be back on the runners relatively soon.
Another quick story, Alex. I'm sure that you've probably heard about this on social media, but there is a mysterious virus that's attacking dogs over in Norway, and they've done something pretty unprecedented over there. They've canceled all dog-related events, including dog shows and agility trials and obedience trials and all sorts of things. And we're mentioning it today, number one, because Norway is a hotbed for not only dog-powered sports on snow, but also dryland sports, mono sports, bike touring, that sort of thing. But what's interesting about it is they have no idea what it is. They don't know if it's a fungus. They don't know if it's a virus. They don't know if it's a disease or what. But it's really impacting the dog community over there. And that's a real scary thing. And I know we've talked a lot about on this show about how illnesses and viruses can spread really quickly on Iditarod, in particular with kennel cough and things like that. And I know in years past, Parvo has been really bad in some of the villages when other dogs come in and, you know, they're not vaccinated or whatever. But that's a scary thing when you're dealing with potentially hundreds, if not thousands of dogs in a country that participate in dog-powered sports. Have you heard anything about that, Alex? And if so, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I hadn't heard anything about it until you just mentioned it, but it you're right. It's a very scary thing. And it hopefully they will find out what is going on and be able to isolate it and find a treatment or a cure for whatever this is. But these kind of outbreaks are very, very frightening, and especially when it's not really clear what the cause is. And there's a lot of common sense things that people can do and that most people do, you know, to prevent viruses from being spread. But you know, there's a certain amount of you know, of contact with the dogs and contact with food and common areas that dogs go into, particularly in race conditions where they're all passing through the same area or stopping briefly at the same checkpoints. And so that's a very scary thing. I also wonder, you know, just in terms of Iditarod, we've seen Dallas Seavey has been over in Norway the last few years, starting with his sort of feud with the ITC, but then continuing. And I'm wondering if the cancellation of these events over in Norway might cause him to reconsider and perhaps return to the Iditarod.
You know, that's an interesting subject, and it would be interesting to see how that plays out. But it would also be interesting to see if Norway places some type of quarantine ban. And I know it's only mid-September now, and of course we have a long time before the mushing season really kicks off. But, you know, if they don't get a handle on this and it begins to spread, think about human-type viruses like, you know, the really bad ones like Ebola and swine flu and bird flu and that sort of thing that can quickly spread around the world really, really fast just by coming into contact with another sick person, sick dog in that location. And the next thing you know, you have a worldwide problem. And I don't know if it'll get to that, but I know that they're taking it very seriously. I know that the government is now involved. You know, this isn't something that they're going to just deal with at a race level or at a dog club level. The government of Norway is now involved with this. So I think it's something we ought to watch out for, in particular as we're moving forward. And I say that also because recently I interviewed all of the guys and gals that are doing the Dryland Championship over in Sweden. coming up in October, so in about a month from now. And I'm sure that a lot of dogs that are really close to Sweden, up there in Norway, Denmark, you know, the Scandinavian area, will be traveling to those races in Sweden. And I just wonder how that will impact those travel plans as well.
Yeah, you know, and it's we live in a world where there is a lot of movement and there's a lot of freedom for people and dogs to move around and go to different countries. And I'm thinking back to, you know, in the 1925 serum run, which was a slightly different case because it was not a dog disease, but in the serum run days, things were relatively localized. There wasn't that level of travel, and there wasn't, you know, if something was, if there was an outbreak, it usually was very, very localized. And what we're dealing with now is, you know, people can get on a plane, dogs can get on a plane, and, you know, 15, 18 hours later, they're on the opposite end of the world. So it's a very scary kind of thing. And there's a lot to be concerned about with that.
So let's jump over into our next story. And it's interesting, Alex, over the last 3 or 4 years, there's always one prevailing story in the off season. And I know you and I have talked about it many times on the show that now Iditarod and the other big races are now sort of a yearly or year-long event where news is happening all the time. And that wasn't very much the case just even a few years ago. And I think social media really had a play into that, and the social media really has a play into the story that we're going to talk about. But we're going to mention an interesting case where Jim Lanier, he is an old school musher. He's in his 70s now. He's ran in 20 Iditarods, I believe, and he applied to run in the 2020 race. And I don't know exactly when he applied, but just about a month or so ago in August, the qualifying board of Iditarod denied his application and said he could not run. And that's caused quite a bit of a stir, quite a bit of a controversy. What I'd like to do, Alex, is like we typically do on our Iditarod coverage, is take a fan's perspective and a musher's perspective on this and see how it plays out, at least on kind of a debate on our level. So can you set this up a little bit better than I did? And then, of course, give your thoughts, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, so Jim Lanier is a kind of a fan favorite. He is, as you said, very much an old school musher. And his sort of claim to fame is that he has run the Iditarod in every decade that the race has existed. So he ran it in the 70s. He took some time off and ran it in the 80s, ran it in the 90s, ran it in the 2000s and in the teens. And I think a large part of the reason why he wanted to run in 2020 was so that he could say, well, I've run it now in this decade. And perhaps that could be a prelude to him retiring from competitive mushing or you know, retiring from the Iditarod or something like that. Now, there is a lot of people are not aware of this because it hasn't really been a factor until the past couple of years, at least not in a public way. But there is something called the qualification board, and when you enter Iditarods, you have to have completed all of your qualifying races and all of that. But then, in addition, I believe the qualifying board will review every application for someone who applies to run the next race. And this was something I wasn't really aware of until Hugh Neff was rejected by the qualifying board and not allowed to run in Iditarod. I believe that was last year. And And people don't know a lot about this board. It's not clear who's on the board, for example. I believe it is mostly or maybe entirely Iditarod finishers who are on it, but it's not at all clear who's on it. And they looked at Jim Lanier and looked at the races that he's run in the past few years. And I know that he has scratched from Iditarod, I believe, three or four times in a row now. And they rejected his claim, and people quickly took sides, as we tend to do these days. And there were a lot of people who were saying, well, they're just discriminating against him because he's older. And people have pointed to other older mushers who have run and Colonel Norman Vaughn and Dan Seavey, and suggested that, well, maybe the Iditarod is clamping down on him or making an example of him because he's not as well known or he's not as famous or he doesn't, bring as much press attention or whatever. I've heard a lot of those kind of remarks. So I think that's basically where we are right now. And I have some thoughts about that, but I'd love to hear what you think, going in just from a musher's perspective about the situation now.
From my understanding, the qualifying review board has been in place for several years now. I remember around the time that I moved here in 2010 was when they were talking about adding that into the rules. And I'm not sure exactly what year that they did it, but it's very clear that it doesn't matter if you've done your qualification races and you've got your application in and you've paid your entry and all that. Let's say you do that at the picnic in June. So if you think you're ready to go and you apply, that application is accepted, but it still has to be reviewed by this committee. And I believe it's a 3-person committee, and you're right, I don't think it is known who's on the committee. But after that application gets over to that board, at that point they decide yay or nay based on some criteria. And one of those criteria that I did not know until this case came up, that if you scratch in, I believe it's 4 consecutive races, then you're automatically disqualified and you have to re-qualify starting all over again. And that means going and doing your 300 milers and your 200 milers and getting the personal reference and doing the report cards and all of that. So I think that's the basis for Jim Lanier's disqualification was because of the scratches. But I also think that they took into play his running during the Yukon Quest last year. And I know that his wife, who seems to be the vocal one of the group, at least on social media, has said that he did a very impressive run in the Yukon Quest. He finished. He didn't finish in last place. He did finish, and he had a good run, so that shouldn't be held against him. But if you remember, Alex, he had a terrible time out on the Iditarod Trail the last time he ran, and Scott Jansen supposedly had to save him on the trail. He was near death, and all that drama that was going on during Iditarod, that was, of course, part of this as well. So I think that the rules are pretty clear that if you do X, Y will happen or Z will happen or whatever. So I think that's where it stands right now. So I think it's pretty cut and dry. But what I find most interesting is just the blow up from the followers of the race and the fans and just sort of their perspective on it. I know that there's a petition out there on change.org. I don't know if those petitions have any weight at all. I know that they do them for all sorts of things to impeach the president and to change gun law and all these sorts of things. but I just don't see how it is causing such an uproar for, like you said, a musher that, you know, isn't a big name. It's not a CV or a Mackey or a Zirkle or a Boozer. It's a musher that's relatively little known, at least in terms of the majority of sports. So I find it really interesting. What is your perspective, at least from a fan's level?
So let me first say that I love the Iditarod, and I come at all of this from a position of loving the Iditarod. And it is maddening sometimes, because it almost seems, and I know this is not the case, and I know that the people in the ITC are doing the best that they can and are trying to reform things and are trying to make the race run better so that it can be successful for many, many years. But it sometimes seems like they are shooting themselves in the foot with some of the things that they do. And I forget what the exact issue was, but Jim's wife had spoken out publicly and been very critical of the Iditarod and the ITC, I believe, just shortly before this decision was announced. And I think that's part of what has fanned the flames on this a little bit, is there's a perception that maybe the ITC is picking on him for having spoken out or having criticized them. And the gag rule applies not only to the musher, but also to the musher's immediate family. So there's a little bit of that going on, but I don't feel like I'm in the position where I can say definitively this is fair or this is not fair. And I find that I have to rely on the experience and the judgment of people who have a lot more, mushing experience and who have race experience and who are like really people who are on the ground and can make that decision better than I can as a fan thousands of miles away. But having said that, what I always think about is, the real problem here is the lack of transparency and the lack of adequate communication. And I don't think that the ITC has done a very good job of communicating to the fan community what the actual procedure is. And that makes people think, oh, well, it's a good old boys network, or, oh, they are playing favorites and they let Lance Mackey get away with things that they wouldn't let other people get away with, or they let, you know, this musher get away with things that musher wouldn't be able to get away with. And there may be some of that going on, but I don't think there's as much of it as people think. I think it's just that the ITC doesn't really communicate what's going on very well. And I'm not saying that we need to know the names of the people on this board so that they can be harassed, but I think that we need a lot more explanation of what the procedures are and what the reasoning is behind some of these decisions, because these things just come out and they're sort of, you know, they're very oblique, and we don't have a good way of understanding what the reasoning is. And from my perspective, that's the big problem, not this specific case, or not what Jim Lanier does or doesn't do, or how he can qualify or requalify to run Iditarod, because I think that there's already with the whole doping and Dallas Seavey rigmarole from a few years ago, there's sort of a lingering feeling that something is going on that's not quite right. And the way to fight that, I think, is to be a lot more open and a lot more, and to communicate a lot better why things are being done. And I know that there's been a big change in the ITC board, and there's a there's a new person heading up the ITC, and I just really hope that they will be a lot more open and a lot more communicative to their fans, because I understand that people on social media need to have something to fight about, but I feel like a lot of this could have been handled much, much better.
Great points, Alex. And I'm going to take, of course, the opposite side to a lot of what you said. The first off, you had talked about there needs to be a procedure in place. And I think that that's pretty clear. And if you read the rules, and I know a lot of people that are listening are going to go to Iditarod.com and pull up the rules as soon as they hear this, it's pretty clear what it says in the rules in regard to this qualification committee. And if it does say that if you scratch X number of races, this is going to happen, it looks like that's what happened. So that's my first point on that. Second point, and I'm going to take this a little bit from a sports management perspective, and I put this on one of the Facebook threads the other day. Recently, I've been involved in a graduate program in sports management and learned quite a bit about how sports operate and how they're, you know, protected legally and ethically and all of that. So I'm going to take a little bit of a sports management perspective on this. And I said on Facebook that there are business decisions in sports, and then there are decisions that are made purely on the field or purely from a fan's perspective. And I am fully I fully believe that sports could run without fans. And I think the Iditarod is a great example of that. Just because the fans want something does not mean that it's appropriate to take place in the sport, whether it be the Jim Lanier situation or whatever. I think the fans have a say, but there's still a business side of sports. And I think that's what is happening here. Procedures were broken and rules must be followed. And I bring this up to how we talk about other sports a lot, and you talk about transparency and we should know about it and more information should be talked about. And if you think about the NFL, players are suspended, fined, cut, whatever, all day, every day. And very rarely do we hear about, you know, the offensive lineman that was cut from the Miami Dolphins. And I say that specifically because typically that offensive lineman is not the superstar. And I preface that by saying that Jim Lanier is not a superstar player. He's not the Tom Brady of the NFL, or he's not a wide receiver or whatever. So he's just an athlete that gets out there and competes. So he would be similar to that offensive lineman. And if that person were cut, if that person were fined, you're probably going to see a blurb about it on the trailer on one of the on the sports networks, and that's about it. And then it's just going to kind of go by the wayside. And of course, people that are diehard fans of that offensive lineman or of the Miami Dolphins or their family or whatever are going to be rather upset, but they're not going to cause this much of an uproar that's shaking the boat of the entire sport, because this rule was broken, and then of course this fine or penalty was imposed. And I think that's what's going on here. But what I find also interesting is there's no procedure in place to appeal. And I know that's also in effect in other sports. For example, in the NFL, if you're fined or cut or whatever, you get to appeal to the commissioner's office, and the commissioner makes the rule that he imposed. And I think that that's wrong. So I know that that's an issue in Iditarod as well. There's no appeal process. You just kind of take your lumps and kind of go with it. And then I know that's where Hugh Neff is at. I mean, he was expelled or withdrawn or whatever the wording is for the race last year. So he's in the same place. So I don't know. I don't have the experience that a lot of folks have, but at least from a sports perspective and a mushers perspective, I think that we have to take the rules as they are written and pay for whatever indiscretions that there are, whether it be several scratches or as in Hugh's case with the problems in the UConn Quest or whatever. I don't know. I definitely don't think that they should backtrack just because the fans are in an uproar. I think that would really set a bad precedent if they said, okay, yeah, you guys are right. We're going to pull back on this. And because so many people are vocal, we're going to pull back and we're going to let him in. What are your thoughts on that, about having that mass just kind of just forcing the issue? And should they change because of that?
You know, I basically agree with you. And I think my overall point isn't that they should necessarily do anything different, but that they should just communicate better. And yeah, it's in the rules that there's this review board, but I look at the rules every year. I'm pretty sure you look at the rules most years. I don't think the majority of fans ever look at the rules or ever, you know, even know where to look, where to find the rules. So I think that there could be, a much better communication, and they could, instead of just saying, no, he's out, they could explain, this is the policy that we have. These are the rules. We've had this review board for however many years. This is why we're doing this. And I think that that's really the missing step, is the communicating why they're doing it. I tend to put faith in people who know a lot more than I do, and give them the benefit of the doubt that they are doing the right thing. A lot of fans don't do that. They have these knee-jerk reactions. And I think that we could cut off a lot of that by just having the Iditarod explain and communicate their decisions in a clearer and more straightforward manner. I totally agree with you that it would be wrong to backtrack and to let him in just because the fans have made an uproar. I agree that does set a very dangerous precedent, because this is a race and an organization that should be run by the people who know what they're doing. And frankly, the people who are running the ITC and the people who are running the race know tons more than I know as a fan about mushing, about dogs, about, you know, the trail, about everything that goes into the race. So as much as I have my opinions and I would have my preferences, I think it would be a big mistake to give fans like me, even relatively well-informed fans, control, any kind of control over how the race is run.
Alex, we're just about out of time, and I want to make sure that I give you the last word on this, but I have one thought in regard to how they should inform us. And you talked about that being a big deal. So my question to you is sort of a two-parter. The first part is, how should they inform us? And then, of course, what should they say? And I asked, how should they inform us? Should they do a press release like they do during Iditarod? And you'll note that almost all of their press releases say the same exact thing. John Smith withdrew at Unicleet for the best interests of his dogs, and that's all that they say. And you either accept it or you don't, but that's the press release that we get. So do you think that we should get something like that? And then secondly, should they release the information in terms of protection? And I know that Mitch Seavey got on one of those threads and was pretty adamant about saying that there's been many people that have been disqualified, and typically they just silently walk away for a year or two. You know, they take their lumps and just kind of, you know, go into the background a little bit, because they were suspended or withdrawn or rejected for one reason or another, whether it be, you know, committing a crime like domestic violence or getting a DUI or, you know, scratching or whatever issue it is. Should that be public knowledge? And of course, all of that is public knowledge already, but do we need to have people's dirty laundry out there, even on a press release, for the reasoning why that they were withdrawn? I really don't agree with that. So what are your thoughts? I'm going to give you the last word here before we close.
You know, that's a very, very tricky thing, because I think there is, I don't want to see people's dirty laundry generally either. But I think there's a way to communicate without necessarily getting into all of the details. I would love to see more than just these boilerplate press releases. And I think if I were running the ITC, I would release videos. I would release short videos. I would maybe whenever something happens, I would videotape the announcement and release that on social media. I think it would be great also if the ITC or if a spokesman for the ITC would maybe be available to have regular video chats with fans. I know that's a lot to ask, but I think that there would be so much goodwill that you could garner by doing something like that, even if it's just, you know, like 5 or 10 or 15 minutes once a month. So I would really be in favor of something like that. I don't think we need to know details about someone's DUI or someone's arrest that's causing them to be disqualified. But I think a little bit more information would be really, really helpful. And, you know, I realize that's a very slippery slope, and there's probably a lot of things that go into the type of information that's released, including legal stuff. And they, you know, obviously the ITC doesn't want mushers suing them for defamation or anything like that. But I really think those kind of closed off sort of secretive things that lead people to think that there's a secret cabal of Iditarod mushers who are, you know, doing things behind closed doors, that worked and was very effective for a long time in the history of the race. But I think that given the media and social media context that we're operating in today, we really need a little bit more. And I know that's a lot to ask, but the Iditarod has such a close relationship with so many of its fans and really has like built itself as such a fan-friendly organization that I think there's a way to do that that wouldn't be too burdensome for the Iditarod and would really get a lot of goodwill back from some of the fans who have been miffed about some of the things that have happened in the past few years.
So in closing, Alex, how do you think this is going to play out? What are your thoughts on the ending of this saga?
You know, I think it is, honestly, I think it's going to blow over in a month or two. I think I don't think a lot of people will remember it once the snow starts falling.
Interesting. I tend to agree, and that's typically how it happens these days. As they say, we live in a 24-hour news cycle. What happens today, you typically don't remember tomorrow. Alex, it was my pleasure having you on. I'd love to hear the other side of a debate. I think that's what makes this show pretty special, is we have that very interesting perspective. So, again, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you again soon here on the podcast.
Excellent. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.